Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue this week with further explorations of the culture of consciousness. When I was a young lad in school, there was a particular article that people were really into, Cyborg Manifesto. And the Cyborg Manifesto was an article about a way of thinking about using a science fiction figure, this idea of the cyborg, the half human, part animal, part technology, as a way to investigate what we are, what we're becoming, how to think about who we are without falling into the standard traps of human being, of human consciousness. So its author, Donna Haraway, was particularly interested in feminism, and so she was trying to think about a way of thinking about women that would both resist the typical mainstream congealed ideas of what women are, but also not, in her mind, fall back into a kind of hippie essentialism where women are in touch with the flows of nature and the tides of the moon and all that kind of witchy stuff, which she thought was not really the way to go, but instead how to look at the cyborg, the science fictional creature, as a way of moving forward. And it was a very, very popular and influential essay that really, in a way, brought a kind of science fiction into philosophy, into contemporary ways of thinking about culture, about thinking about how we're relating to technology, how we are transforming as we move forward. So I was very interested a couple of months ago when I stumbled across a text called the Centaur Manifesto. And I knew what the guy was talking about. And it turned out that I actually knew this guy. I saw it mentioned on Twitter. And he's a fellow named Ted Friedman, who I know, and we both contributed to the same pop culture magazine at college, a wonderful organ called Nadine. But hey, ooh, our music is coming back. That was exciting. Before I bring Ted on, I want to introduce, of course, our lovely co-host, Maja Daou, the White Witch. Maja, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Are you good? A little technical weirdness there, but you're back with us. I'm happy to hear it.
I'm totally here.
So I know you're a big mythology buff. Can you tell me something about centaurs? I mean, I know about them, but I don't really know very much, like a story or anything. I know what they look like.
The centaur story is actually really crazy. I had researched it because I'm a Sagittarius, of course, which is represented by the centaur. And in mythology, this guy, Centaurus, is actually like this bastard child who's like totally deformed. He's like really gimpy, and no people will talk to him, like, so he has no friends. So he has to go like live in the mountains all by himself. And where he is in these mountains, he comes across like a herd of horses, basically. And so the horses become his only friends, and it's because he mates with the horses that centaurs are born. From this, like, gimpy outcast dude, that, like, leads to this progeny of these half-horse, half-people that are, like, kind of born out of this castaway, you know, that came out of a union that Zeus had been, like, punishing this guy that was lusting after his wife and kind of, like, tricked him. And so this guy, Centaurus, is born out of that union. And so the centaurs really are this, like, weird symbolism of trying to amalgamate our humanity and our primality, like our animal nature, and how we all have these, like, you know, especially sexual instincts, and trying to integrate them into our kind of intellect.
Yeah, well, we think about centaurs as being kind of lusty and good warriors and such, but they were also wise. I mean, wasn't Alexander taught by a centaur?
That's right. They taught all kinds of people, and they healed everyone, too. Like Chiron, right, was one of the most famous centaurs, and he, like, literally was the healer dude for everyone in Olympus. And so he was, like, the sage shaman guy as well.
All right. That's good stuff. So let's bring on Ted. Hey, Ted, how you doing?
Hi. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. Welcome to Expanding Mind. So I'm kind of curious, just right off the bat, would you rather be a cyborg or a centaur?
I was thinking about that, and then I was trying to decide if those Old Spice commercials had made this argument more or less relevant. I guess the answer is just about any centaur we see in a TV commercial or in the movies is a cyborg as well, because it's digitally created, transmitted to us through technology. And so I think all of us all the time are negotiating our relationship with nature and also negotiating our relationship with technology. And so the point is that all of us are living every day of our lives in some ways as cyborgs, in some ways in centaurs. And my piece was really about trying to explain why certain stories, certain metaphors, seemed particularly compelling to so many people in recent years, and concluded it was because there was an urge, a desire, a utopian hope to make better sense of our relationship with nature in the context of a historical moment where there's a real, crisis that we've brought on in the natural world. Mm-hmm. And so I think what I was doing in part was, and your question I think alluded to that, I was inspired in part by Donna Haraway's very influential essay in the 1980s, and I'm not sure, which of your, how much of your audience would be familiar with it, but those of you who are sort of, if you were in grad school in the 90s, I'm sure at some point you read Donna Haraway's influential essay, Cyborg Manifesto. And what she was doing in that essay was responding to a previous generation of academics who had been very wary of technology, really technophobic in a lot of ways, coming out of that particular strand of the New Left in the 1960s. That wasn't the only strand of the New Left, but that had dominated in a lot of places around academia and particularly the humanities. And she was arguing against that and arguing that that engaging with technology and engaging with the the political potential of technology, the unavoidable ways in which technology even using this word technology is already to reify something that's just an integrated part of our daily existence. But anyway, she wanted to cast more of a light on that. And she was writing at the same time as which Frederick Jameson was writing his very influential work about postmodernism, when postmodern artists were emerging and being widely noticed, all the way from pop figures like Talking Heads to crossover figures like Brian Eno. This was a period in which, and the boom in science of dystopian science fiction, of Blade Runner Brazil, this sort of cultural peak of science fiction, there was really the emergence of cyberpunk as a sensibility that wouldn't really cross over to the mainstream until The Matrix in 1999, but which was building up steam starting in the early 1980s. And that's really what her Cyborg Manifesto came out of. And her famous essay ended, "I'd rather be a cyborg than a goddess," and she was responding there to goddess feminism, that one strand of sort of new agey feminism that implied what's often called as well difference feminism or essentialist feminism, the idea that women are inherently superior, that if we all worship a goddess and embrace feminine values, we'll have a better kind of world. And in historical reality, phenomena like the rise and success of Margaret Thatcher certainly demonstrated there was nothing natural and inevitable.
It's interesting. It's such a kind of wave, a sort of pulse, because I was, very like you, very much in the swim of things that you're describing there in the 90s,
yeah,
very influenced
more
than me,
actually.
Cyberpunk, by science fiction, by the sense of how technology was transforming our sense of politics, our sense of who we were, moving forward through all of that. And yet what you're kind of pointing to with the Centaur Manifesto and other stuff you're talking about is this sort of return with a difference of some of those earlier values. Paganism,
yeah,
magic, the sort of sense of a natural ecology of spirits, of possibilities that kind of play off and move in a different direction than the sort of hard, futuristic, often dystopian kind of, you know, get over it, kids, anti-nostalgic sort of perspective.
And
so what do you think led to that? What is that shift about?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd want to say is I don't think this is a rejection of what came before. This is dialectic, or that to call this a dialectic, the, you know, shift between technophilia and technophobia, is to call it a dialectic is to use a Hegelian language, and also to use a Marxist language about thesis and antithesis creating synthesis. You know, somehow we could put science fiction sensibilities and fantasy sensibilities together to create some other thing. In some ways, I think that is what's going on, certainly in something like steampunk. Or even the Star Wars itself, which is this hybrid of fantasy and science fiction. But rather than use that metaphor, the metaphor I like is to try to turn to the metaphors of the fantastic tradition in the first place, in particular, the way Jung talks about alchemy. And then alchemy is really, I think, Jung turned to it because it was his own, in the same way that Marx turned Hegel on his head and claimed his own version of the dialectic, in the same way that Derrida, you know, claimed his own version of the dialectic by claiming deconstruction, that there are these binary oppositions that need to be deconstructed and rethought.
Well, that's one of my favorite things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that there is this fantastical connection with hard science, and that the majority of, like, kind of progress in hard science comes from people's dreams or visions that they have.
Oh,
you know?
Certainly,
But with alchemy,
you
can look at Isaac Newton, who discovered the laws of physics, and he was studying alchemy and astrology. And with astrology, it was coming all from those, like, Greek myths and archetypes and stuff like that. So these, literally, these fantastical figures are the ones that fed our laws of the physical universe that, like, any hard science is based on.
We are the children of that who have Oedipally, you know, resisted acknowledging our own roots in something before science. Eric and I were having this debate with this another great friend of ours from college, Andrew Jaffe, who's now he's an astrophysicist in England, right? And this was over I had referred to something. I had made a reference to Darwinian fundamentalism, and he was sort of startled by that phrase because for him those are complete opposites. Well, I was actually quoting the paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould, and he was referring to certain evolutionary theorists who insist that Darwin knew everything, that natural selection is exactly as Darwin described, and that don't include advances or developments, ideas since then, like Gould's own ideas about things like punctuated equilibrium. Anyway, Andrew was sort of startled to hear, I think he lives in a world where to be smart, to be rational, is to be an atheist, or at the least to be a sort of atheistic-leaning Buddhist or something else vaguely spiritual like that. But I think he just hadn't really been exposed to a point of view that argues that that scientific rationality has its debt and its roots in the fantastic and the mythological.
Exactly. There's that book Adam and Archetype, right, which has Carl Jung and Wolfgang Pauli's discourses with
perfect example. The 20th century, the great scientific advances of the 20th century were about breaking through the constraints of our understanding of the physical world based on our immediate physical environments and understanding, you know, things like quantum mechanics and things we still don't understand and can just hypothesize about, like string theory, but this is an area that gets into something I'm sure you guys must discuss in your show a lot, but it's certainly a source of anxiety from my field coming out of academia, which is veering into the pseudoscientific or the new agey In ways that academic institutions get really nervous about and really
uncomfortable about. Well, Ted, I'm really curious about this. So I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit. I mean, I know that you've gotten more interested in magical thinking and Jungian ideas, and you're not going over to the other side of, you know, full New Agery, but you're interested in some of this stuff in a way that
I see what you're doing, and go, wow, that
might be a little difficult for him sometimes. So is it changing? How do you approach that in terms of being an academic?
Well, I would say, first of all, in terms of full New Agery, whatever that would mean, I mean, New Age is just a term, a label claimed by some people. The Australian post-Jungian writer David Tacey has written several really interesting books. There's this, in much of the world, Jung had a much greater influence than he had in the U.S. In the U.S., Freud became much more influential for actual psychoanalysis in academia and in related fields like my own field of media studies. Freud is the canon, and thinkers in the Freudian tradition like Lacan and Zizek, Jung is taboo. There's actually a book by a colleague of mine called Tabooed Jung about how Jung became taboo. He sneaks in the back door through lots of figures that are quoted but whose histories aren't really understood by the people, many of the people quoting him, like Gilles Deleuze. Deleuze was a critic of Freud, very much in the Jungian tradition. Anti-Oedipus is really, as far as I understand, and I don't claim to be an expert on Deleuze, an extension of many of the same kinds of critiques that Jung was making. And
actually, there's more and more people who are working on Deleuze who are kind of excavating the Jungian background.
That's
and so there's more and more explicitly hermetic and magical approaches to this, recondite philosopher.
How's this? I hope you guys can help save Deleuze from the Deleuzians. I think there are a lot of Deleuzians I encounter in academia who are basically, they've worked their way through Lacan and are burnt out on, you know, and are moving on and trying to find out what else is out there, have embraced Deleuze, a certain model of Deleuze, but I don't think are willing to, maybe I should be less defensive about it. Maybe they, you know, I think hopefully, you know, having embraced, found interest in Deleuze, they can now, you know, find something of interest in Jung. Certainly my own approach is sort of scattershot. I knew Deleuze before I knew Jung just because he was in the air in grad school in the 90s. But, I came to Jung, my own personal route, which was via Buddhism and my own, you know, personal psychotherapy and, you know, trying to heal myself. So anyway, I think in the end, I think there's a lot of stuff about academic trends where Deleuze is hot one, you know, year, you know, Foucault was hot one year, and then, you know, you go from queer theory to disability studies to one trend after another. Actually, as an academic, you sort of have to follow some of the trends because you have to figure out when you're picking a dissertation topic, what are people going to want to be hiring on 2, 3, 4 years from now when I'm on the job market? But ideally, what you do once you have some stability and some choice is try to pursue your own intellectual and theoretical interests, you know, wherever they take you. And for me, that took me more and more to this Jungian stuff because it resonated the most. It explained what I cared about. It helped explain. I started with Star Wars and trying to understand why Star Wars mattered to me so much. And there's a lot of great scholarship on Star Wars, but not much on why we dream about Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I turned to Joseph Campbell because researching the history of Star Wars, you read about George Lucas and the influence of Hero of a Thousand Faces on him. Wrote Joseph Campbell, was dissatisfied with Joseph Campbell, but could see there was clearly something there. I read a wonderful book by the theorist of myth, Howard Siegel, about Joseph Campbell that talks about Campbell's roots in Jung, and started reading Jung and concluded that a lot of what I like the best about what people find in Campbell, I think is there in a richer and deeper form in Jung. And
Joseph Campbell is a student of Heinrich Zimmer, and a lot of people forget about Zimmer, and I always kind of like to remind people. And I mean, he did like The King and the Corpse and wonderful stuff like that, and so he did, like, Jung had an influence on him, but Joseph Campbell, a lot of that stuff came out of Zimmer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I should admit here, you know, I'm traveling out of the world of critical theory and media studies where I got my training. I went to I got my PhD in literature from Duke in the 1990s, where I worked with Janice Radway, who wrote a wonderful book called Reading the Romance about romance novel fans, and with Frederick Jameson and other people at Duke at the time. And So I just in the last few years started, you know, becoming fascinated with, well, actually for me first it was Buddhism and then Jung and then alchemy and then these assorted ideas. And I'm just diving in at this point. This is all stuff that I figure you guys know a lot more about than me. I stumbled across this stuff and got really excited about it, and I'm trying to figure out what sort of pathways or what sort of, to use the term I was talking about before, what sort of zizigi, what sort of union of opposites, merger, and what sort of child may emerge out of bringing together the post-Marxist and post-structuralist theory that I was trained in with the post-Jungian ideas that I've, you know, been discovering and find so fascinating. And calling it Jungian or post-Jungian is just a sort of label. It's, you know, you could label it New Age. I just think this is something I talk about in one of the essays that's online on my website and that will be in the book as well. I think Campbell's influence in the New Age, unfortunately, was in part to depoliticize it and to focus it on a very individualistic model. Campbell himself had quite conservative politics, and Jung did as well. But I think there are strands of post-Jungian theory and figures like James Hillman who have a much more politically sophisticated understanding of how individuation and personal transformation has to be of a piece with social reform and in some ways, at least metaphorically, social revolution. So anyway,
I'm curious though, just a little bit more on your own journey. It sounded to me that like some of the reasons that you were drawn to Buddhism and then to read more deeply into these sort of archetypal figures, and probably it sounded like to some degree even go into your own imagination and discover that this, you know, goofy 1977 super hit movie was actually this really real touchstone of your own way of feeling through the world. Mm-hmm. Like, what were you doing kind of personally? What was happening to you personally that drew you into these, what became a more intellectual experience as well of these three?
Well, actually, I should say, first of all, this is something I wanted to write about that's hard to write about as an academic. But there's a short autobiographical piece I wrote for the online academic journal Flow called Vertigo that's about this. And it's, all the articles I'm talking about, by the way, are linked from my website if you go to tedfriedman.com. And I also tweet at Ted Friedman. But anyway, this piece I talk about it. And basically what I describe in the piece is that, I went to grad school really excited about the field of cultural studies, which in the early 90s was a big deal. The early 90s was also a moment when people were being encouraged to go to grad school and told, the baby boomer generation is going to be retired. There are going to be huge numbers of jobs in grad school. That didn't work out that way, and I'm sure those of you who are listeners who are academics know about the changes in the academic job market over the last 20 years. But certainly, I'm glad I went to grad school, and I went to a program in literature because I really wanted to work with Janice Radway, who wrote this wonderful book about romance novel readers, reading the romance that became hugely influential both in feminist studies and in cultural studies and became the roots. If those of your listeners who've read Henry Jenkins, for example, or any of the work in fan studies, in my field of media studies, scholars interviewing fans, studying fan discourse, fan websites, discussing the power of fans, and thinking about what this new transmedia moment when fans can become media producers as easily as media consumers through YouTube and things like that. All of that actually, I think, Janice Radway's ethnographic work in the early 80s, you know, was the seeds to a lot of that scholarship. And then I was also working with Frederick Jameson, who is obviously a brilliant and sort of intimidating figure. And, you know, it's not like I had a lot of one-on-one conversations with him, but I found his work really inspiring, and I'm still working through and thinking through the ideas of his work. And I was also just a really exciting place to be because there were so many, you know, really interesting students doing such a wide range of work there. I ended up doing more, I was always more interested in movies and TV and things like that than books. So I ended up in a communication department here at Georgia State. What specifically led to my interest in these concepts, I would say, would be a fairly typical case of burnout on the academic rat race. And I was very lucky to land a tenure track job, to get tenure, to be the place I'm in today. I have many brilliant friends who, you know, have had really tough times because the academic job market is so exploitative and brutal. The tenure process is also a really grueling and frightening thing, this whole phenomenon of publish or perish, especially for someone like me. I came out of the world of freelance music journalism. After writing for Nadine, our college publication, I freelanced for a while for Spin, Details magazine. I was trying to make a go of it as a freelance writer, the way you ended up doing. But I saw that it was a hard road to hoe, and I didn't have enough steady work, and I didn't like the temp jobs I was doing, so I went to grad school instead. But I always had an inclination to be a public intellectual. But at the same time, the pressure of publish or perish is to publish with an academic press, and, you know, things like, you know, writing magazine articles, even, you know, prominent magazine articles don't get you the credits you need to get tenure. Anyway, I got over that hump and all that, but it left me sort of frazzled at the end. And also, I guess I'd say I spent so long kissing ass and so long where I had to please other people, I think I was a little disoriented about what really mattered to me. I was really at a loss after getting tenure with what to do next and how to figure out what was really authentic rather than just the voice I'd produced to please my dissertation committee or book publishers or reviewers. You know, the academic process to get your work published, you jump through so many hoops, you go through so many gatekeepers. The concept of tenure is wonderful for freedom of expression, but the professionalization process of academia can really suck you dry of all the enthusiasm and creativity and eccentricity that you had before you started. So it took me a while to figure out what I really cared about at this point, because I was certainly pretty burnt out on the subject of what had been my dissertation and then my first book.
Well, fascinating thing. I mean, in a way, like in retrospect, you were set up perfectly for your new interests. And so I want to talk more about that stuff when we come back. But right now, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind, Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking with Ted Friedman, or I should say Dr. Ted Friedman. And we'll be right back after these messages.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists strive for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Ever wonder why some people have successful lives? Well, let's shrink about this. Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Barrow, author of Matchlines with Singles and the Malia and Teacup Self-Esteem Building Series for Children. Please join me and my guests every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to explore psychological and practical problem solving, from personal issues to world events. You can call in to join the conversation or just enjoy listening. If you're looking for balance in your relationship, career choices, family, and your planet, please join Dr. Molly Barrow and Shrink About This Tuesday at 10 Eastern on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis and Dr. Ted Friedman, who's working on the Centaur Manifesto. And Ted, this is something that I always kind of bring up with people because it's a fascinating subject for me, and I was wondering what your take on it is. Like, you were talking about how everyone is kind of either a cyborg or a centaur, and to me, I always view technology as part of nature and part of, like, I think the reunification of alchemy and the fantastic with science is to kind of reintroduce technology as something natural. And it's funny because, like, the topic of your writings with cyborgs and centaurs, those are like hybrids, you know, these unifications of these seemingly opposite forces. And so hybrids are always kind of alchemical, symbologically. I mean, I think really they're taking these two things that seemingly can't occupy the same place in space at the same time, and it's they're doing the Mysterium Conjunctio together. And even just looking at pictures of these things, it does that in our mind. So I was wondering what you kind of think about that. Like, what is that, like, demarcation of where technology starts and nature ends, or is there a difference between?
Well, there is. If you draw a line, then you've just drawn an arbitrary line. You've created a false dualism. And actually, I should say those questions of false dualisms, binary opposition, that's what obsessed critical theory during the time I was in grad school, the time in which deconstruction and post-structuralism, which had emerged in France in the 1970s, saturated the American Academy, well, really starting in the 80s and into the 90s. And so those were questions I was compelled by or, engaged with, but felt that the answers to those questions that were coming out of my fields of academia were unsatisfying. I felt Jameson and that line of thinking was the most compelling and exciting, but I felt like I didn't have any actual answers. These were questions that really were compelling to me because ultimately they're questions about the spirit and the soul and what happens to us when we die and what matters in life. All these questions that I wanted if I was going to be an intellectual and I want to understand, I want to ask these, and I could see that, the trendy academic field didn't seem to even, I felt were a little unambitious in asking those questions. Cultural studies is very good on the political, but not very good on the metaphysical. And post-structuralism, I felt, just ran into dead ends. And then, actually, for me, first I turned to Buddhism. I've been casually meditating for years, and then during this period, which was really a kind of, for me personally, it was a kind of dark night of the soul or spiritual crisis, or just, midlife crisis or post-tenure crisis. Meditating more, learning more about Buddhist theory and in general about Eastern philosophical traditions that aren't bogged down in the same Cartesian dualism of, and it's a dualism that precedes Descartes, but the Western dualism, the dividing mind and body, dividing, nature and culture, the Taoist model of yin and yang, or the Buddhist models of emptiness, and change. Those were approaches that actually seemed a lot more philosophically, theoretically rich to me than what I was reading than even Deleuze, which now I can appreciate better, but it just seems like a retranslation of these concepts back into a Western philosophical language. So it seems crazy to me to embrace Deleuze and not also go to the East. And if you then look to see, okay, who are the Western thinkers who've really engaged this the most, it's you discover all of this fascinating Jung stuff on the I Ching, on yoga. He was a thinker who was not, in part because Jung wasn't an academic. His wife was rich, so he wasn't tied into academic structures. And he wasn't playing he was playing his own political games, but playing different political games from Freud. He had an open-mindedness and a curiosity about parascience, about religion, about the world that's very different from his, from most of Freud and from most of his contemporaries and from most of the Western theoretical tradition. So that's how I got to Buddhism, then ended up, getting to Jung from Buddhism, and then discovering the strand of post-Jungian thinking that begins to integrate the Western philosophical tradition and Western political systems of thought and the Marxist and post-Marxist traditions into that perspective. There's a wonderful book called Projecting the Shadow by two rhetoricians, Thomas Frentz and Janice Rushing, from the 1990s. That's one of the only media studies attempts I've ever seen that really tries to put together the post-Marxist tradition and the post-Jungian tradition, but it seems to me ripe for the exploration, because I care about Star Wars because of its archetypal figures, because it hits something deep in my soul, and I also care about Star Wars because it's about rebellion against an empire, because it's a kind of utopian political fantasy too. So another way to put it is the external world and the internal world need to be understood together. You know, the feminist term, the personal is the political. I think I'm trying to see how these approaches can come together. And as you guys were describing, you know, the alchemical tradition, the marriage of opposites are metaphors and strategies and ways of conceiving how things, unlikely things, can come together.
Right.
That are yet another example where that's, I think, a set of tools, conceptualizing tools that are actually better than most of the tool or better in many ways than the tools we've been bequeathed from the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment.
No, I think pop culture is incredibly important that way, and it continues to be that way, although I think it's a little more self-conscious about it than it used to, in terms of Philip K. Dick has a line that the symbols of the divine first show up in the trash stratum, that there's something about the pulp and the pop.
That's a great line.
That intensify the kind of incoming power of these things, so because we mostly consume them sort of trivially without thinking, oh, this is important, oh, this is significant, and meanwhile a lot of the intellectuals are ignoring these things, and then they can come in and like rock your world and really change how you see things.
I think that's
a really important thing to think. And I think it's also changing, too. Like, I think people are more and more aware of that as being an element of pop culture.
Yeah, certainly. I just wanted to ask, I think you told me once, you're working on a book on Philip K. Dick, is that right?
Yeah, I'm probably, you know, because I'm one of those fools who's even further behind you in the academic slot. So I'm going to be I'm working on Phil Dick, and I'm working on the exegesis. There's a publishing project right now to put out a larger edited edition of the exegesis, and I'm working on that. So yeah, I'm keep being interested in Dick. I still think he's incredibly relevant, and there's still a lot of things left to say. But I'm driven by a lot of the same motivations you are. I mean, I that's a lot of the reason I wasn't in academics, because I wanted to pursue these questions in a free way. But at the same time, there's a lot of resources there that are very very interesting. But I wanted to ask you about something you mentioned in one of your email to me about something I don't know anything about, which is this game Farmville, and somehow you have looped this game, this computer game Facebook thing, into Jung and synchronicity and stuff like that. It sounds like a wonderful place to locate a little bit about how you're approaching these pop cultural phenomena. So if you could just tell me what Farmville's about and what interests you about it.
Well, I assume some of your listeners will have at least encountered Farmville.
No doubt.
It's in, I think, the dozens of millions in the U.S. at least. So, massively multiplayer online role-playing games have been the future of gaming for some time, but the most successful have been these big, high-powered war games like World of Warcraft, which I talked briefly about in my essay, The Politics of Magic, actually. But what's really boomed over the last year have been these small little Facebook games, like Farmville, where you sign up to run a farm and you plant crops and seeds. It's sort of a variation on The Sims or those other kinds of simulation games. But what's different about it is the way it leverages social media. You sign up to be in a neighborhood with all your Facebook friends, and it's easy to contact them since they're already in the Facebook. You're already networked to them as part of Facebook, and the game encourages you to make as many neighbors of your farm as possible. You get more goodies, more rewards. You gain more experience more quickly the more friends you have, and that also works as a kind of marketing scheme or maybe pyramid scheme for Farmville, because that means that to to do well at the game, you have to be a marketer for Farmville. You have to promote Farmville, you know, like it was a Tupperware or something. What's that sort of pyramid-y? Well, that's that sort of thing. That's one aspect of it. That's the business model of Farmville, because they also sell, you go to any Target or Walmart, you'll see these little gift cards that you can buy for kids who don't have their own, you know, or, you know, just as a gift to let you buy stuff on Farmville to customize what's really your avatar in the game, the little version of you. Avatar is the word we're familiar with because it's the word that comes out of science fiction. But this is a good example where the science fiction metaphors are probably inadequate. Avatar was the word that Neal Stephenson, I think, used in Snow Crash. But we could also call that little device a demon. And a demon is a really neat word to use because it has a dual resonance. On the one hand, it's a demon, like out of mythology, demonology. On the other hand, the concept of the demon has a rich history in science, of Maxwell's demon, of scientists hypothesizing about magical creatures that would allow you to perform certain kinds of hypothetical experiments, which then leads in the 20th century to the development of the demon as software code. So a lot of computer software, like when you send an email to a listserv, you get an email back from the mailer demon. We also call these kinds of things bots. They're the same thing. They refer to the small little bits of code that run programs. So to call that a demon is to compare a bit of code to a magical creature, and to compare both in term to the sort of figure of yourself that appears on the Farmville screen.
That's so, like Laplace's demon too. Laplace, who had like determinism, mm-hmm. right? It was like a thought experiment that Laplace did, which mm-hmm. was literally like a computer code.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Oh, and then on the other side, though, there's the wonderful Philip Pullman series. The Golden Compass is the first one. It's the His Dark Materials series. And in that fictional universe, all of the characters grow up with these magical demons that are like pets but are psychically attached to them. And these evil bad guys, Nicole Kidman plays the bad guy in the movie, is trying to slice the demons off children, which is a horrible crime and leads to the children and the demon both withering away and dying. And anyway, this is a magical universe that, in a sense, is extrapolating from the bond, both the bond we have with our pets, which is a whole other theme of a lot of contemporary studies and the ideas about posthumanism and animal studies, but then also the way in which we have totem animals that represent an animal side to us, just as you guys were talking about earlier with the centaur, that represents the parts of ourself that we don't fully embrace, or that the animal urges in ourselves that are not only physical sexual urges but also a kind of knowledge and wisdom about nature and the world. I talk about these concepts in my class, my fantasy class, that I teach at Georgia State, when we look at Wizard of Oz. And so Toto is a kind of demon to Dorothy, and a totem animal for Dorothy. Toto does the things that Dorothy's afraid to do that need to get done. Toto is the one who busts out of social convention that's trapping Dorothy down and lead Dorothy forward, until finally Toto's the one who actually reveals that that the Wizard of Oz is a fraud. This is the rich mythological tradition of which avatars and icons on a Farmville computer screen are the latest expression of. And the problem with the metaphors of science fiction that look only forward or only look back as far as the early history of science fiction, so you can have, I guess, retro science fiction from the 20s and 30s. But beyond that, you just don't have as rich a set of metaphors, and I think you get in, you risk becoming affected, or maybe that's not the right metaphor, but you be distorted by a scientific mode of thinking that thinks all that metaphor stuff is just, you know, flowery poetry, and what really matters is polygon mapping and bit rates and, you know, the price of everything and the value of nothing. So anyway, I think all of these metaphors that come out of fantasy, and you can see it in the fact, why is it that what people are playing is World of Warcraft set in this medieval world, or going to see Lord of the Rings, or playing Farmville? If we live in this high-tech futuristic era and people are on these amazing new technological wonders, why aren't they pretending to be in spaceships? Why aren't they fantasizing about the future? And I think the answer is, because when we have the opportunity to have our imaginations loosed, what we find we crave is the nature we've left behind, the disenchantment of the world that we're responding to. What Jung says is that myth is compensatory. And so the myths, the stories we tell ourselves are stories about a lost pastoralism. Now that could turn into easy nostalgia or romanticism for a past that sucked in all sorts of ways. If you were black, if you were a woman, if you were poor, and sucked in lots of ways, even if you had the best of it. But what fantasy represents in terms of a mode of thought, a way of life that has something of value that can't simply be turned back to, but can't be rejected, that needs to be remembered and appreciated and reintegrated. I think those are a set of metaphors that people hunger, that people crave, because they're healing metaphors, because they're metaphors that help them and help all of us in turn understand the way we live our lives.
Do you think there's a limit on how do you conceive of the limit of what popular culture can do for us? And I said, let me just give you a little backdrop, because you and I are in many ways on a parallel track, where I was also very influenced by the ideas of the way that fans recompose and recontextualize the objects of their fandom into things that are really meaningful for them. I wrote an article about Klingons in the early 90s and talked about how a lot of them were pagans,
right?
And
yeah,
they were using
that.
This imagery in order to create meaning for their lives, and they did it in some very sophisticated ways, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always been very invested in that, huge popular culture fan, music fan, all that stuff. But more recently, in the last few years, even as I continue to consume media, and maybe it's because my own personal life, I'm not that invested in any particular pop universe, although there's things that I love, of course. I sometimes wonder whether there's a sort of limit to what you can do, because there's still this kind of relationship to spectacle or relationship to a sort of a generated object. And even with the massive online, you know, role-playing games, which I obviously are a different category because you're as much in the spectacle as consuming the spectacle, in fact, even more so, nonetheless, there's something about the degree of mediation, and I don't know whether I'm getting old or I'm getting cranky or what it is exactly, but I have concerns about this as well, and I'm really curious to hear how you think your way around that.
Well, the dialectic you're describing is the dialectic that Frederick Jameson describes in his wonderful essay that I think is really the seeds of American cultural studies, Reification and Utopia in Mass Culture, where he argues that he was writing in the 70s, actually, and he was writing about The Godfather and Jaws were the examples he used. And his argument is that every work of popular, he was responding in a sense to Theodor Adorno and the Frankfurt School and traditions of mass culture critique that argue exactly what you're suggesting, that certainly often seems like an accurate depiction of a world in which, well, in the world that has the Tea Party, there are a lot of people who seem to be deluded or at least seriously misinformed and poorly educated. That culture reinforces ideology in a lot of ways. This is a political understanding of the world that, unfortunately, I think, you know, that historically the New Age perspective hasn't recognized, you know, this ideological critique. But anyway, Jameson, in response to that, pulled out work by this fascinating early 20th century Russian structuralist, Ernst Bloch, who develops an idea. He has a book called The Principle of Hope, in which he talks about utopia. And he talks about how every popular culture text, in order to capture our imagination, has to have a little seed of utopia in it, a little moment where we can glimpse a better kind of world, and that's what speaks to us in these pop culture texts. Jameson, somewhat pejoratively, but it's a wonderful phrase, calls it a fantasy bride. You know, you watch this movie and momentarily you imagine a better kind of place. Now, this is sometimes what's pejoratively called escapism, but I think that's a term that just doesn't answer the question. Where do you escape to? How do you get back? How have you been changed? What's been changed by the kind of your escape? What does it mean that you've labeled your everyday experience something that you want to escape from? All of these are things that pop culture can do. Jameson argues at the same time, though, that inherently it's reified. And by that, he's borrowing Adorno's term to describe how mass cultural texts end up individualizing social problems, mystifying possible collective solutions, all the ways in which capitalist culture is compromised and frustrating and disappointing and unsatisfying and needs to be unsatisfying to get us to buy the next thing in term, planned obsolescence. Anyway, I think that framework, the dialectical framework, Jameson is such a dialectical thinker, but we can also talk about it as a kind of alchemical framework. I think that's those are the questions to ask when we engage any text, but not just pop culture text. Those questions don't go away if you're listening to a symphony or reading William Burroughs or going to Burning Man or having a conversation with friends. There are always, you know, both utopian aspects and potentials and moments of, to use Deleuze's terms, moments of becoming. And then there are also moments that then get reified. And so we always have to be alert to that. But, I mean, it's, you know, the ancient myths were tools of power as well. You know, something like Star Wars is a tool of power and ideology, also a source of resistance, also a source of spiritual meaning. It's all of those things. But mostly I just can't avoid it because I dream about Star Wars. I dreamt about Lost when I watched Lost. I try to just be an astute observer of my own psyche, you know, follow, you know, the music I want to listen to, the stories that really compel me, and then just ask critical questions about why. So it's not a case that I said, oh, I think pop culture is where the action is. I better study that. Oh, now I wonder if it isn't. It's a case of what is capturing my imagination, then why has it captured it?
Yeah, I always wrote record reviews that way. It was funny. It was like, even, you know, I was, you know, ostensibly a critic, but I didn't really felt like that I was much of a critic because I didn't actually care about rendering judgment. I just listened to what I got. It made me excited, and then I tried to articulate that. And the game of articulating what excites you, what moves you, what haunts you, is so much richer to my mind. But I think it didn't make me a very good critic sometimes. I remember particularly because I'd write about metal, and I would write about metal that would hit me in a certain way. And sometimes it was just like the album cover or the song titles or something, and I would do these like long, intense pieces, and I'd have friends, I mean, even people who are like metal fans, who go, man, I bought that record, but I don't know what you're talking about. And they might have been right. I mean, they might have been, you know, whatever. They might have been like standing in for a lot of potential listeners. Whereas for me, it was about resonance, the whole idea of resonance, that you go through the world, through culture, through people, and you just listen. You listen for the resonance, and as soon as the resonance happens, you activate it, and it's an object of your own exploration, your own intellectual work, but also your own heart work, and that just seems to be a good way to go through things.
Yeah, I completely agree. I would have to say that's an issue. There may be parts of it that are idiosyncratic to you, that are aspects of your, to use the Jungian terms, personal unconscious. But oftentimes what really resonates because it's activated, in Jungian language, an archetype. It's activated something that really resonates on a very deep level. And depending on what kind of New Age or Jungian you are, you could describe whether that archetype is hardwired or part of some sort of collective field or just our cultural inheritance. But somehow there's something about Lost and Star Wars and the other things I find I really care about. And they're not all purely pop culture. There's, you know, I'm trying to think of something weird and esoteric. I like Stephen Sondheim. Most of my friends don't like Stephen Sondheim. I like, you know, but whatever it is I'm responding to, I'm also trying to figure out, you know, why, you know, some ways I'm responding personally, and I'll try to understand, you know, what does that evoke about my own life, my own personal experiences. But also I'm trying to figure out, you know, working with archetypes is very tricky because it's dangerous to generalize, to say I respond a certain way so everyone else responds a certain way.
Well, it's interesting too because they get broken down into different echelons, like even just being a woman who's interested in hard sci-fi and fantasy, like you see how these archetypal kind of, you know, images are directed at certain people to get a response from certain individuals and then not other ones. And like to say that you affiliate with certain responses from particular pop culture movements, but then not other ones is kind of an interesting.
But I guess the approach I learned from cultural studies and from my advisor, Jan Radway, as well as from writers like Henry Jenkins, is to just approach every subculture with sympathy and empathy. Janice Radway, you know, wrote about romance novels without condescension and with the respect that was really pioneering and hugely influential. And Henry Jenkins did the same with Star Trek fans. And both of them, and Jenkins also admitted, I'm a fan too. I'm an academic and a fan, and it's okay to be both. I guess what I, so what I want to do is try to tap into what I, the utopian impulse I see in whatever text is moving me, and try to be, capture what I think is moving, what it is about what it's, what it is that's moving me that I think may help explain what's moving other people too. And that can only be a hypothesis. But in the case, to give an example, in the case of Farmville and World of Warcraft, I think pastoralism is one of the things that's really compelling about those, that there are these fantasies of this natural world that people crave. I know that because I felt that in myself, and I tried to examine, and I'm a meditator, so I tried to mindfully look inside my heart and my thoughts and see what am I responding to in this game, and I concluded this craving for a certain sort of nature, of which the locavore movement and other things like that are also pieces of that same moment in the zeitgeist, that same ideological impulse and utopian urge. So I see it in myself, and I think my own experience is reflective of that as other people. I can't assume that's that way for everybody, but I think that's what a good critic does. You know, I don't agree with Pauline Kael or Grill Marcus with every review they write, but they always help me understand what I think by so clearly articulating what's going on for them.
Great. Well, Ted, thank you so much for talking with us on Expanding Mind. I wanted to mention that you can go to TedFriedman.com to, and that'll link to any number of other. He's very widely distributed on the web. It's very nice and appropriate for your enthusiasm. So, from Maj and me, thanks so much. Keep your minds open.
Thank you.